Roughly 5% of the criminal population is responsible for more than half of the crime. This hour, the successes and failures of our criminal justice system. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. In the first half hour, I'll talk with ISU sociologist Matt DeLisi. Tonight, he'll be giving a talk in Ames that offers another framework for assessing our criminal justice system. It draws on his experiences working with the most pathological offenders. After that, we'll listen back to my conversation with Holocaust survivor Max Rodriguez Garcia. Now is a great time to make your pledge of support for our fall fund drive. Now the news.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Decades of research around the world have shown that roughly 5% of the criminal population is responsible for more than half of the incidents of crime. Not only that, this group, this 5% of the criminal population, accounts for between 50 to 90% of the most violent crimes. These are crimes such as murder, rape, kidnapping, armed robbery. Now, that group will be the focus of a talk being given this evening at Iowa State University in Ames by Professor Matt DeLisi. The title of his talk, Severe 5%, Understanding the Criminal Justice System. Matt DeLisi is editor-in-chief of the Journal of Criminal Justice, professor of criminal justice studies at Iowa State University, and an affiliate with the Center for the Study of Violence there. Matt DeLisi, welcome back to our program.
Hello, how are you today?
Hey, very good. Thank you for joining us. Now, I want to talk a little bit about what you're going to be talking about tonight on the ISU campus. Severe 5%, Understanding the Criminal Justice System is the title of your talk. I believe we talked 3 or 4 years ago during some testimony that you gave before the Senate Judiciary Committee. Perhaps in a minute we can talk about that. But before we get into the framework, for those who don't know your work, tell us about your experience and who you've been working with in your research, your clinical settings, and then we'll evaluate or be able to better judge what you have to tell us after that.
Sure. Well, I have been at Iowa State since 2000. And prior to coming to Iowa State, I was a pretrial services officer at a large county jail in Colorado. And I did that for 5 years, and that experience entailed interviewing arrestees and gathering information about their address history, work history, criminal history, and then setting bond on them. So I was able to interview several thousand offenders, ranging from very boring, mundane traffic violators all the way up through very serious and violent offenders. Since coming to Iowa State, I've also had a research relationship with United States Probation and Pretrial Services and done a number of projects with them on a variety of populations, sexual offenders, violent offenders, basically whatever the agency is interested in studying more. And in my own research, I've tended to focus on more violent, more serious offenders that are the greatest threats to public safety, and that also, unfortunately, are the biggest challenges for the criminal justice system to try and correct their behavior.
Mm-hmm. So when you talk about this 5% so-called pathological offenders, describe that group a little bit more. What is meant by pathological?
So there are lots of studies over spanning several decades, and this research has come from studies nationwide, has found that about 5% of the offender population, statistically, accounts for more than half of all of the crime in any population. And when you consider the most serious crimes, murder, rape, kidnapping, those sorts, they account from anywhere from half to nearly all of them. So this 5%, and they're variously called career criminals or life course persistent offenders, they have a number of monikers, they're very persistent in their offending. They start offending very early, and they tend to be the type of offenders that effectively don't change their behavior. So they can be incarcerated over and over again, and you see very little reductions in their antisocial behavior.
How early do we know what type of offender we're dealing with? I mean, it would be nice wouldn't it, in a certain sense, nice in a certain sense to know the first time someone offends, are they in this group or not, right?
A big indicator would be the age that they first offend. So if someone has a very early onset prior to age 10, that would certainly be a red flag. And also, if their onset offense was very serious, so particularly a sexual assault or a homicide or an armed robbery, those pieces of information are very helpful. The unfortunate thing with these offenders is because their behavior is so unpredictable, they're often very difficult to predict. And so we often have to wait a number of years until we can get their criminal history in sort of full context before we can realize, okay, this is one of these severe 5%.
Right, right. And in the meantime, a lot of societal costs come, right?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So in your talk tonight, you have a different framework for assessing our U.S. criminal justice system. Describe that and I guess juxtapose it, because what you're saying what you're seeing in our criminal justice system is different, I'm taking, than the perception of our criminal justice system that most people have, the reality compared with the perception.
Sure. And so my basic thesis is that the criminal population, the offender population, is extremely diverse or heterogeneous. And the individuals in the population have a lot of range in terms of their capacity for antisocial behavior. And in the same way, the criminal justice system offers a broad range of sanctions to respond to these behavioral differences in the population. So if you look at the criminal justice system, it has some responses that are effectively non-punishment and diversion, but has ones as serious all the way up to incapacitation in prison or even death. And so I think the general public often has a skeptical or critical view of the criminal justice system in terms of its relative success. But what I'm going to talk about tonight is that you really have to specify which part of the offender population you're discussing, because for most offenders and for most people who are non-offenders, the criminal justice system is very effective. It's a very formidable deterrent for people who never get arrested. And for those who might get arrested once or twice in life, there's programs in place that are very effective at helping to target whatever problem areas they have, which usually are relating to substance use. And so the good news is that for most people, the criminal justice system works and is quite effective. For this severe 5% group, however, it's repeated failure. And what I want the audience to think about is, should we really blame, so to speak, the justice system or the prison system specifically for the failures of someone who's been incarcerated 10 to 20 times, or is the failure more reflective of their behavioral deficits?
Mm-hmm. You recently co-authored an article in City Journal, and I'll just read the title, What Criminologists Don't Say and Why Monopolized by the Left, Academic Research on Crime Gets Almost Everything Wrong. The first sentence of the article begins, the history of academic criminology is one of grand pronouncements that don't often prove out in the real world. Explain quickly. We don't have much time. The points that you and your co-author make in this article.
One of them is that many criminologists over the years have not had direct practitioner experience or direct clinical experience working with offenders. And so they've tended to have a almost romanticized view of what their behaviors were like, and in terms of what causes those behaviors and how the system should respond to those behaviors. And so that article was sort of very much intended to kind of shake up the field on a variety of issues to get them to become more honest and realistic about the various behavioral deficits of criminal offenders.
Mm-hmm, right. And I know you run against a lot of opinion with that article. What kind of reaction did you get?
It's been surprisingly positive. We've had a number of folks who have sent us emails who were very pleased. They said one of the more current ones was, everyone knows what you said was true, but no one wanted to say it. And they praised us for writing that. We've had a few people who were, you know, obviously very upset about it or have just a completely different take on things. And that's fine. I think as long as it generates thought and discussion, then it's a good thing.
Mm-hmm. You say in this article, in short, while academic criminology has had much to say about crime, most of it has been wrong. And then you ask the question, which I'd like you to answer briefly, how can an academic discipline be so wrongheaded? How did we get here? Yeah.
Part of it is just the experiences that they have. And so if you are a criminologist and you've never worked in the system and never interacted with a real criminal offender, you have to wonder, to what degree can you really understand their criminal behavior, if it's entirely theoretical or entirely academic in its orientation. And so we raise a number of issues there where having that more direct day-to-day interaction with offenders and with how the system actually operates, rather than from a theoretical perspective on how they believe it operates, it gets going in a lot of misguided directions.
Mm-hmm. Do you get the sense that articles like yours, I know an article cannot change things overnight, that and with the reaction that you've got, that actually criminology is studied in academic institutions across the country will take a different approach?
I think so, because the positivity of the response has been nice, in that I think a lot of people were waiting for someone to say something like that. It's a very bold and strident article, and that's not a lot of people's taste. And so now that someone else has done it, then perhaps others are going to come out with a more sort of empirically driven, experience-driven focus. The other part of it that directly relates to tonight's lecture is, for a long time, criminology didn't really study the more pathological offenders. It sort of left that study to forensic scientists, and I think that's been a mistake. I think mainstream criminology should have always been studying the most violent offenders.
Matt DeLisi is with me, editor-in-chief of the journal Criminal Justice, also professor of criminal justice studies at Iowa State University. Let's address this. This is often mentioned in the media. Your take on this. The incarceration rate of the U.S., we know, is the highest in the world by far. I think these are statistics a few years old, but perhaps you have newer ones. The U.S. represents about 4.4% of the world's population. However, we have around 22% of the world's prisoners. How does that fit into your work and your different framework for looking at criminal justice in this country?
Well, everything is relative. So within the United States, 0.5% of the U.S. population is in confinement. And so if we know that, based on tonight's lecture, that 5% of the population is going to be a pathological offender, you could ask the question, why isn't at least 5% of the population in confinement? Because that would match empirically this small, severe group.
Okay, then you have to ask, why in other parts of the world is it so low, right? I mean, that's what you're steering toward, right?
It's very low. It's probably too low in most parts of the
world. Right, and we have a lot of countries that have a lot less violence than the U.S., so help us make sense of that.
Another big difference between the U.S. and other nations is the number of homicides. So that's also what sort of distorts our prison population, is with so many homicides, which almost always are going to result in confinement, you're going to obviously have more than peer nations would who do not have as many homicides.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we'll come back to this conversation at some time in the future. Fascinating area of research. Matt DeLisi, editor-in-chief of the journal Criminal Justice, also on the faculty at Iowa State University, being talking tonight at 8 p.m. in the Iowa State Memorial Union Sunroom. Matt, thank you for joining us with your research.
Thank you very much.
I'm Ben Kiefer with River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Today you're listening to an encore edition of the program. My guest this half hour is Holocaust survivor Max Rodriguez Garcia. Garcia was born in Amsterdam in Holland in 1924. When he was in his teens, Hitler's military invaded Holland. That was in 1940. Garcia is the author, along with his daughter, of Auschwitz, Auschwitz, I Cannot Forget You As Long As I Remain Alive. In it, Garcia shares his remarkable story, the loss of his family, and his survival of the notorious death camp Auschwitz and three other camps. In 1945, at the age of 20, he was liberated from a labor camp in Austria by the U.S. Army. After that, he immigrated to the United States and served in U.S. counterintelligence. It ferreted out the SS members from the war. He went on to have a family, become a successful architect in San Francisco. Max Garcia will be speaking tonight, Thursday, March 16th, at the Fairfield Arts and Convention Center. That's at 7:30. It's free and open to the public. He joins me now. Max Garcia, what a pleasure to have you. Thank you for making time for us.
Okay.
You are now in your 90s. You've been telling this story for a long time. I want to ask you to tell a few parts of it for us today. Let's start with, when do you remember first thinking that you and your family in Holland were in real danger from the Nazis?
When my sister was picked up with a place where she worked on a Friday afternoon, and we never, the last time we saw her was at breakfast, and then all of a sudden the rumor mills began that they had all been picked up where she was working, and she could not make contact to us. We didn't have telephones, and so we found out that she was at at Westerbork at Northern Holland to be transferred to some place, and they didn't know where they were going to go. We didn't know, had never heard of Auschwitz in those days.
Mm-hmm. What was the reason given for why your sister was taken away at that time?
Because we were Jewish, and we still are.
Mm-hmm. What then happened to the rest of your family? What did your family do after your sister was taken away?
Then my father and mother decided that I should go into hiding, and I went into hiding in Amsterdam on the 2nd of January, 1943.
Mm-hmm. What about your parents? What did they do?
They've been gassed. My whole family is gassed, either in Auschwitz or in Sobibor.
Mm-hmm. Back in Holland, though, when you went into hiding, did you go into hiding with your family, with your parents?
No, by myself.
Mm-hmm. Where did you hide?
In Amsterdam by a family on a second floor apartment house building. And my parents were by themselves. My father was a diamond polisher, and my mother was a hausfrau. Women didn't work in those days.
Mm-hmm. You were in hiding for how long before you were discovered?
I was in hiding until about the middle of July. My parents had come to visit me in my hiding place on my birthday in June, the end of June. And then they were picked up in early July, and they were sent to Sobibor, where Sobibor was the favorite place of the Nazis to send the Jews from Holland in. And I was then picked up, or betrayed rather, I betrayed to my own stupidity. That was about the middle towards the end of July when I was finally traced.
Mm-hmm. Betrayed, how so?
Well, because I had been infatuated by a young woman during the summer before. And I wrote her a letter, which I had been doing when I was at home. And there was a man who came every night to dinner at where I was hiding. And then he would leave. And one night I said, would you please mail this letter for me? And there was a stamp on it. And my return address was, that's what my stupidity was. I didn't even think that my home address would be alive still, so I put my hiding place address on the envelope. And he was picked up that very same evening. They went through his pockets, and they found the letter, and then they looked for me, and they couldn't find me.
How did they find you?
Because the son of the family where I was with, they was at the window, and he saw that the black car advised and stopped in front of the apartment. And he told me, get on the roof fast. And I ran up to the roof and I hid behind skylights. That's what I call my stupidity.
And then what happened? How did they finally catch you?
Well, there was a guy, then I got the keys to the apartment of one of my aunts, and I knew where it was. I went up there and I promised the guy who had advised me I would not use any water, I would not use the light on, I wouldn't use any gas on. Everything that I would eat would be cold. And then a guy across the street, an older man, sat in front of his window and saw me going in and out. And he called the police and said, there is a Jew hiding over there. And he gave him the number of the street and the address. And they came looking for me, and then they forced me and they took me to the local headquarters of the police in Amsterdam, asked me who had made my false papers. And I said, they're not my false papers, these are my papers. And he said, we know who you are, so you make no dance with us. And so I wouldn't answer them, and they beat me up for a while. And then the next overnight, I kept in jail. Then I was sent to the transfer place where the Jews were assembled before they were sent to Westerbork, which was the camp Northern Holland, and that was the transit camp from which you went to, you didn't know where.
You went to Vesterborg first of all, and then that was a camp, and then where did you go?
On the train, and we found out 3 days and three nights later at Auschwitz.
You tried to escape, is that true?
No, I planned, okay. You got an idea, but you didn't have it right. I had my bicycle hidden with some people. And so I saw the guy who was advising me that I would go get my bike and fix it up again because I was going to make a run for it through Belgium and Luxembourg into Switzerland. And he said, well, good luck on that. That's not the best way to do. But that's where you get the idea. I was preparing for a trip through to Switzerland, but I never made it.
Mm-hmm. So did Auschwitz, that name, of course, is synonymous with horror these days. Did it mean what it means today, then, at that time, in 1940?
Well, it was, there are two camps. There is Auschwitz I, and there is Auschwitz II. Auschwitz II is where all the gassing and the murdering took place. And Auschwitz I was the administrative headquarters for all the camps around the area. They were administered out of Auschwitz. But it also had work facilities. And I came to Auschwitz from Buna, which was a camp that were building, that existed to build an IG Farben building, where they were going to make artificial rubber for the tires of the tanks and for the jeeps and other stuff where they needed rubber that they could no longer get out of Africa.
And so where did you end up in this network? Auschwitz is a network of Nazi concentration camps and extermination camps. Where did you end up?
I wound up the main building, the main headquarters, Auschwitz I.
Mm-hmm. Over a million, I just wanted to remind our listeners, for those not as familiar as you are, over a million people were killed in Auschwitz. Around 90% of those killed were Jewish. Tell us about your thoughts and your existence in Auschwitz.
Well, when we came off the train, it was 4:30 in the morning. The spitz dark, and then all of a sudden, all the doors of all the cars were opened. And the lights were turned on, and it was all of a sudden like your confusion. And the dogs were barking, and fellow prisoners who were in Auschwitz already were out there trying to talk to us, and they spoke Yiddish and German. And we from Holland didn't understand Yiddish, and we didn't understand, and I didn't understand. There was nobody in my group on the train who spoke German or understood it. And so there was a total confusion, and finally we were set up. The women were on one side of the tracks, and the men were on the left side of the track. And we were all in a line of five people horizontally. And there was a whole group then of, and then we were selected to stay alive or to be going to the gas camp, which we didn't know at the time. We didn't know why they were picked to go to the left and go to the right. And then slowly but surely, after a few days, it began to realize that we were now prisoners and that we were in a concentration camp and that we were lucky that we were alive because the other people were going straight to the gas chambers.
How did they determine who would live and who would die?
If I had that answer to that question, I could make millions. Nobody knew. We didn't know what we would. The whole idea of getting off the train in the middle of the night with bright lights, with dogs barking, was to confuse you, to make you not clear thinking, because you didn't understand what was happening to you. 3 days on a train with no windows, the cars had no windows, straw on the floor, and there were about 50 people in a boxcar. I mean, you know, you're totally confused. You get no food on those 3 days, no drinks, nothing. And then you all of a sudden, out, leave your luggage right. You get your luggage later on and where you're going to go. Mm-hmm. And we even stood there. And the men who had their wives with the kids on the other side, they tried to scream to each other. And then the guards, the SS guard, would say, stop it, you can't do that. So it was brutally confusion, total. And even when I sit here with you now, I'm trying to find the right words to describe it, and I can't do it.
If you've just joined us as a listener to River to River, I'm speaking today with Holocaust survivor Max Rodriguez Garcia. He's now in his 90s, liberated from a labor camp in Austria in 1945 at the end of World War II. After a year at Auschwitz, I understand you developed appendicitis. Tell us what happened there.
I came to the clinic. I was in Auschwitz, Maine, Auschwitz number one. And it was late summer, early spring. I mean, early fall. And I started getting pains, and I requested that I be allowed to go to the clinic. It was permitted, and I went there. And the doctor, who was always a fellow Jew and but also a prisoner, he took a look at me and gave me a couple of pills and a piece of paper that said I didn't have to go to work that day. It's Friday. And they sent me back to the block. And I went next morning, I went back to the clinic, gave me two more pills and a piece of paper, and I didn't have to go to work on Saturday. Sunday, we didn't work at all because it was a Sunday. And on Monday morning, I went back to the clinic, and the doctor said, "Are you still here?" I said, "Was I not supposed to be?" And then he picked up the phone, and he called the SS doctor on duty that day. And he said, "I got a 20-year-old kid, Jewish kid, who has a 4.5-day acute appendicitis that can burst any minute. What should I do?" He said, "Get him to the operating room. I'll be right over." And then I was taken to the operating room, undressed, put on the edge of the gurney there, or the boat table. And the guys with me said, "Bend over and grab your knees and make your back in tight." And then the doctor came in and put a needle in my spine. And that was the first time I heard later on that I was an experiment on that score. And I was anesthetized through my spine. And then I was there, the doctor was there, and there was an orderly standing to my left who was held a piece of cloth on a thing in front of me so I could not look into the light over the operator. Otherwise, there were no other people in the room, just the three of us. And there were no nurses, there were no women nurses as we are accustomed to here. There were no male nurses, just the doctor, me, and the person to the next to me.
You said experiment. What was the experiment they were doing on you?
Spinal anesthesia.
Did they then remove your appendix?
Yeah, they wanted to. I was frozen from the neck down. It's awfully fast. They put the needle in, they stretch it, and all of a sudden you can't use your arms. Nothing. The only things that you could use was your eyes.
Tell us how you came to survive Auschwitz, how you came to leave Auschwitz.
Because we marched out on the 18th of January, 1945. And we were marched out. We were the last people in Auschwitz. These were the so-called prominent prisoners. And we were marched out. They didn't tell us where we were marching to. And we marched for 6 days and six nights. You have to understand what marching means. It doesn't mean like the army with music. You know, step, 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 step. This was just one foot in front of the other slowly. It was slogging more than anything else. Mm-hmm.
And this is as the Allies, the Russians are advancing from the east. The Western powers advancing from the west, so they are force marching you to the interior of Germany. We remember Auschwitz was in occupied Poland, right? So you're being marched toward Germany, away from the advancing Allies.
We were still presumably able to do work for them in their other countries where the Russians presumably could not get.
Mm. So you arrived in Germany. What camp was your final camp? Austria is the site of the labor camp where you saw your final liberation by the U.S. Army in 1945?
No, you're wrong. we went to Mauthausen on the Danube. And we had to march up to the hill, and there was the Mauthausen was looked like a fortress from below. And that's where we went. The survivors of the train ride, which was 10% of the people who went on the train back in Auschwitz, had survived. Mm. There was 10% came out of the train, and 90% had died on that trip. Mm. I'm one of them who didn't die.
Tell me about the Day of Liberation.
The Day of Liberation was Sunday. It was Sunday, May 6th. And on the day before, on the Saturday, we were all who could still walk and bow. We were ordered to come to the Appellplatz, and there stood the commandant and the officers. And the guards were all around us with machine guns. And the commandant then spoke in German and told us he wanted us to go into the tunnels that we had been building for the factories that they were going to use, because the Americans were already in Gemunden on the other side of the lake, and they were marching up, and the guards and he and his officer were all going to fight the Americans, and they didn't want us to be in the crossfire, so they wanted us to go into the tunnels, and we would be safe. And we had already found out through the people who had told us that the tunnels had been filled with dynamite, and if we went in there, they would bomb the dynamite, and so we would have a death there. So we all started saying, no, we're not going, we're not going. And then he had another guy come up, a prisoner, and stood on a table and spoke in Czech and other Slavic languages, and they all started shouting, no, no, niet, niet, no, no, we won't go. And he was amazed, and he walked around with his officers. And overnight, all of the German guards in the SS had disappeared. Mm.
When you talk with people, give presentations, share about your life, what do you find most relevant about your life, your story for us today?
Well, when I talk to younger people, like I will do today, or you know, a little bit later, but yesterday and the day before, the fact that I'm stressing is your can help your own destiny by being adamant, being persevering. And if you're a pessimist now at this age, you're not going to live long. If you're an optimist, you have the whole future is yours. Make the most of it. That's my basic lesson. And then there is tolerance. And in those days, we didn't think about racism because Jews and everybody else was in the camps. And you come to the United States, and I came here, and my basic training was in South Carolina, in Jackson, South Carolina. And after sundown, the blacks were not allowed to be on the streets. And I said, my God, if this is what they're doing here, I'm going to go back to Europe. Because this is weird. And then I found the fountains and the toilets that only were set aside for whites and for blacks. And I said, my God, they've been fighting for us. And then here at home, they're in haywire. So I couldn't understand that.
Do you think anything like the Holocaust could ever happen again?
No, I don't think there will be ever again an industrial-type murder.
When you give your talks, and as you're going to give... tonight. Are there questions after you take questions after telling your story? Are there questions about the Holocaust or that experience that really bother you?
Well, it bothers me when I remember it because I think of my mother, my father, my sister, my aunts, my uncles, my nephews, my nieces, all of whom were wiped out. That is something that I have to live with. The most important thing to me was at that time, the guy told me, he said, you don't have a family, you don't come from a family, you were dropped here from the sky, and you speak Dutch. That's the only difference. He said, but don't even begin to think about your family because that's useless. And that's the first lesson I got from this young man, who probably was a year or two older than I was, who was Polish.
Mm-hmm.
never saw him again. And he gave me very good lessons there, and I'm trying to convey these lessons to the youngsters that I'm talking here to.
I want to thank you so much for sharing your thoughts and your story with us. Holocaust survivor Max Rodriguez Garcia, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Max Rodriguez Garcia will be speaking tonight at the Fairfield Arts and Convention Center at 7:30. His talk is free and open to the public.
River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.